27 nations thinks about immigration, including a number of European countries and the US. So this is a little bit different from some of our usual wider seminar series, which are very development economics focused, and so we're pleased to see a number of new faces in the audience today. This also connects, we were talking about this at lunch, with some wider work on migration recently. So we have out last year, we have a special section in international migration looking at migration, governance, and policy in the Global South. And we have a new collection in the Journal of Ethnic and Migration Studies on migration and integration and inequality. So there's some various connections. And of course, migration and development are really closely interrelated. So there's migration has been a key cross-cutting issue in wider work for a very long time. So let me just turn it over to Neil. He has, I think we said 40 minutes to talk, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Well, thank you, Rachel. It's great to be here. It's my first time in Finland. So it's wonderful to be here. And I heard this is unusually warm. And actually, it is warmer here than it is actually back in Washington, D.C. So today, as Rachel said, I'll be talking about demographic trends and attitudes towards migration globally. So it's pretty much going to kind of present all the various work that we have at Pew Research Center. And there's a lot more, so if you've seen some of the work, you have questions about it, you could feel free to ask about other parts of the center. But just to give you a background about Pew Research Center, we're a nonpartisan, non-advocacy, we call ourselves a fact tank, so it's a think tank, but we don't do policy advocacy. So we don't take positions, and this really just keeps to the integrity of our surveys. Most of our funding comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, who we are a subsidiary of, which is the Pew family who had money from oil, but they divested their oil earnings, and they invest all their money on kind of information and facts. And one of the founders of the Pew family for the center believes that facts are important for societies to function, especially democracies to function. So that's kind of our position. But we cover many different topics, not just global migration, but we cover U.S. politics and also politics around the world. We have an annual survey on global attitudes around the world in about 30-plus countries. And we also do a lot of religion, internets, and society, and also some social demographic trends. So I'm going to start off with looking at global migration trends in general, look at specific migration patterns, particularly of unauthorized or irregular migration, and then also talent mobility. Then I'm going to turn to kind of attitudes towards migration around the world on immigration in general. So first off, this is from the United Nations own data. The number of migrants, international migrants around the world, has increased since the 1960s to just under about over 250 million. This is about 3.5% of the world's population, so it's still a really small portion of total population around the world. But the United States in particular is the largest immigrant receiving country, with over 45 million migrants. And historically, it's actually at a historic high in terms of percentage. We're at just under 14% of the U.S. population is foreign-born, or what we would call a first-generation immigrant. And this has a lot to do in the U.S. Since 1965, before 1965, many countries from Latin America and Asia were not allowed to immigrate into the United States. But it opened up after 1965, and most of this wave of migrants really is coming mostly from Latin America and Asia. But the U.S. is not, in terms of shares, is not the largest in terms of shares of population. You see, actually, just your neighboring country, Sweden, has a lot more in terms of percentage of its population with immigrants. And you can see other countries like Australia, New Zealand, and Canada that have a much higher percentage of its population by percentage terms of foreign-born. Right now, around the world, refugees are at a historic high. We have more refugees now than during the fall of the Berlin Wall back in 1989, and a really rapid increase, especially in 2015 with the Syrian refugee surge. And also those who are displaced, whether not refugees or asylum seekers, or also internally displaced around the world, were also at a record high of just under 1% of the global population. Where are people coming from around the world that are moving? Well, India is by far the largest in terms of international immigrants, where you also have Mexico, Russia, China, and Bangladesh, and Syria as well. But the largest growth in terms of those leaving their countries are not just from Syria, but also many African countries. So this goes, again, from development economics perspective, these are many of the countries that are the largest source of immigrants who are now growing and leaving their countries. So let me turn to a political topic, unauthorized. We call it unauthorized. What does that mean, immigrants? This is what people call illegal, irregular, undocumented. There's many terms for this. At Pew Research Center, we, for the longest time, we've been doing the estimates for over 15 years since the founding. I've been doing estimates of unauthorized immigrants in the United States. And then for the first time last year, we did a unauthorized immigration estimate for Europe in general, EU plus EFTA countries. This is challenging. In Europe, there hasn't been a number since the Clandestino Project back in 2008. And there's been many, of course, changes, especially during the Syrian Refugee Surge that has really influenced a lot of the new populations that are coming into Europe. So I'm going to present some numbers, and there's some definitional issues. What we did, some people, asylum seekers are a very sensitive group. They have legal status in many countries. But for the purposes of our purpose, to make it comparable with the U.S., we have defined unauthorized immigrants by anyone entering a country unauthorized. They don't have a residency permit, so some asylum seekers are in that status. But as we know, some asylum seekers actually get their applications approved, and some don't, and some stay also unauthorized and continue to live what we'd call without legal status. So first, here's the numbers for that we just presented from our report that we just released. This is really just, again, only 1% of the European-wide population is unauthorized in Europe. But you can see the trends from 2004 to 2017. To the left is our estimate with counting asylum seekers, which is about 1 million in Europe and EFTA countries, in EU and EFTA countries. You see that unauthorized immigration has grown from a low range of 3 million to 3.7 million in 2014 to 3.9 to 4.8 million in 2017. And then if you count them without asylum seekers, again, it's just adjusting it by 1 million, especially just recently. Here's in terms of percentage. Unauthorized immigrants in Europe account for nearly 1 in 5 non-EU EFTA citizens. So those who don't have citizenship in EU or EFTA country, this is about, those are 1 in 5 basically immigrants in Europe are unauthorized. And you can see here the percentage-wise, you see authorized immigrants in the EU EFTA is about 20 million. And then you see here about, again, that 3.9 to 4.8 million unauthorized immigrants. What countries have the most unauthorized immigrants? You see here, Germany and the United Kingdom have the most majority of unauthorized immigrants in Europe, followed by Italy and France. And you can see here in the Nordic countries, you see that it's actually quite below 100,000. Actually, especially for Finland, way below. But studies here in Finland show you're talking about like a few thousand. So it's much lower in the Nordic countries, but Germany and UK has a lot. Has come a lot more. And I'll go into the demographics in a few moments. But in terms of terminology, again, as I said, for Europe, we define it by European Union and also the four European Free Trade Association countries, Iceland, Liechtenstein, Norway, and Switzerland. And then again, non-citizens are residents of Europe who are not EU or EFTA citizens. And this has a lot to do because within the EU, of course, you have a lot of free movement. And this is, of course, going to change with Brexit. So I know people may ask questions like, so how many are going to be unauthorized after Brexit happens? I mean, we don't know. That's a big question that people in the United Kingdom are asking, because you do have a lot of people from within EU who are actually in Europe.
Sorry, can I just ask, are you able to distinguish between forced migrants, like refugees or forced migrants who have migrated economically?
No.
So you don't have to motivate?
Yeah, we don't have that, but yeah. And then unauthorized immigrants, again, those without residence permits. And these are the kind of the groups that would fall under unauthorized immigrants. Those who entered without permission, those who probably entered illegally, with a visa, but actually are overstaying their visa, those who are deferred deportees, those who are waiting for deportation or got deportation orders, those who are children born to unauthorized immigrant parents, because many countries in Europe, the United States, you have birthright citizenship, so even if you're unauthorized but your child is born, that child is an American. But in many European countries, you don't have, they don't get automatic European citizenship. But some countries in Europe don't consider children born illegal. And I think a few countries, I think that's in Italy, that's the case. And asylum seekers, again, waiting for a decision. So we had four different methodologies. This was a very challenging project because we've been only doing the United States, and we do what's called the residual method, where we take the U.S. Census. Our senior demographer, Jeff Bissell, has been kind of the pioneer in estimating unauthorized immigration. He used to work at the Census Bureau, and he's with us now. But he was able to take the raw material, raw data, is able to understand who is foreign-born, and then from that you could distinguish who, he has an estimation of who's actually unauthorized, who are foreign-born, from census data. And you can see only a few countries are able to do that here in Europe, which is UK, the colors are hard to see here, but the UK, and I believe France, and Portugal, and Bulgaria, you're able to do this. Other countries, we had to do a demographic or a regularization, and a ratio-based estimation. For the Nordic countries, we had to do a ratio-based, what this is, because you have population registries, we know that you will not capture your unauthorized immigrants because population registries are only of legal immigrants. So we used a ratio of terms of assumption of a percentage of the population, and we're able to make that estimation of the foreign-born. So here is a comparison of Europe versus the United States. You see Europe, U.S. is by far a much larger population of unauthorized, and this makes sense given that it has a lot more immigrants in general. But you see that the United States actually, since 2014, has decreased in the number of its unauthorized population. Here in Europe, again, as I showed earlier, you had an increase, especially after the 2015 surge, and then it's now slowly declining. In terms of demographics, comparing the U.S. and Europe, you see that here in Europe, it's a lot more diverse in terms of the unauthorized population. You see Asia is by far the largest, 30%, where you have Middle East, North Africa, about 21%, and 17% Sub-Saharan Africa. And other European countries, Europe, and then America is about 8%. Whereas the United States, which makes sure because of its border with Mexico, you see that 78% is from the Americas of its unauthorized population, followed by Asia. In terms of number of years, so you see Europe is actually a lot younger. In terms, I've been here for less than 5 years, about 56% majority have lived in Europe for less than 5 years, whereas the United States, its unauthorized population, have already been basically integrated in society, have been there for 10 years or more. And then when you look at age of the unauthorized population, you see, again, it's a little bit younger here, whereas it's much older in the United States. Another, what you do have similarity is the male-female ratio, which is about the same, exactly the same in Europe and the United States. So let me turn now to high school talent. We have a lot of competition for talent around the world. A lot of economies are relying on, especially on high-tech workers. And this has been something that's been kind of, a lot of policymakers always try to say that we want to create a merit-based system or have more people with high skills enter your country. In the U.S. compared to the world, actually, you see that of the largest destination countries, U.S. Immigrant population only has 36% of its foreign-born population has a college degree or more. So what's interesting is that Canada, on the other end, it has 65% of its population has a college degree. So at Australia as well, the United Kingdom, a lot more. But you can see this is in terms of percentage terms, but this has a lot to do with, which I'll talk in a few slides, a lot to do with the selection systems that are created in each country. But when you look at the total number in terms of raw numbers, I mean, the U.S. still has the most college-educated because it's just, you know, we have a lot, the most immigrants around the world. So we do have 14.7 million in the U.S. compared to Canada, 4.4 million. But it's just, but when you look at percentage terms, it's still a lot less college educated in the United States. And this has a lot to do with selection systems. So you see, Canada in the 1970s, this is what everyone always uses as kind of the example, adopted a points-based system. So it, think of it as a college application, right? What are the attributes do you have? Do you have a college degree? Do you have a job? Do you have certain traits? Do you have a science degree or an economics degree? They put points into that. Do you have work experience? So Canada puts that point-based system, and it increases your chances of getting a visa or permanent residency into Canada. They adopted that in the 70s, and suddenly you saw a big trend, increase of percentage of foreign-born with a college degree or more. United States has a hybrid system, which I'll talk in a few slides. France doesn't have a points-based system, and you can see they have a lot of labor migrants in France where they're not getting the kind of more higher-educated immigrants. But what the United States does have is that the U.S. is the top recipient of foreign students studying around the world, with over 1 million currently studying in the United States. These are the top countries of citizenship who are currently studying in the United States. You see that China is by far the most, followed by India, South Korea, and Saudi Arabia, and Canada. And these are the universities, which are pretty great, like some great universities in the United States that have a lot of foreign students. So public universities, Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Penn State University have received the most. On the private side, you see NYU, Columbia University, and University of Southern California. It has really a lot of international students studying there. And what's interesting about the United States is that a lot of public universities have gotten more foreign students, especially since the Great Recession in the U.S. So back in 2006, you had a lot of, during the recession, you had a lot of public universities slashing their budgets. And a lot of those universities started recruiting foreign students because they were paying full freight. So some of my past papers were showing that you do see a lot of public universities, especially in bachelor's degree programs, really recruiting students, foreign students to come. But what happens when foreign students, after they graduate, do they work? Where do they work in the United States? So this is an area that I was looking at. And one data set that the US has is this called the Student Information, Student Exchange Visitor Information System. It's a database that was created by the whole Department of Homeland Security after September 11th that monitors the activities of all foreign students in the US. I was able to do what they call a FOIA request. It's a Freedom of Information Act request, where you could request the raw data. And they gave it to me, so I analyzed it. You know, you have each individual record without their names. But what's great about it is it gives you where they're from, even down to the address of their origin, so you can know the hometown. You know what they're studying, you know what university they're at, and then also what's called OPT. If they're staying to work in the U.S., they're more likely to have what's called optional practical training, which allows a foreign student to work for 1 year or 36 months if they have a STEM degree, a science, technology, engineering, and math degree. And it tells you the information of who the employer is and where that's located. So this data really kind of is very rich in kind of analysis to understand where students are going after they graduate. So here's some of the results of that study. So you see that there were two policy changes from 2008 to 2016 in the United States. Before 2008, all students were only allowed to work 1 year after they graduate under OPT. But then when George W. Bush failed at reforming the immigration system, he used the presidential administration kind of, executive action to allow STEM students to stay longer for 29 months. Then when President Obama was president, they tried to also do comprehensive immigration reform. That also didn't succeed. So he also tried to extend it even more to 36 months for science, technology, engineering, math students. And he also expanded the definition of what is STEM. So some economics, or some, depending on what type of economics, is considered a STEM. So here's all, so you could see that this was a growth, these two policy changes, and you did see this growth from 2008. Where are the students who are staying and working in the U.S. from? Majority, about 74%, are from the Asia-Pacific region, by far the largest compared to other regions around the world. Here are the countries of citizenship. India, by far, is the most, about 30% of foreign students who are staying and work under OPT program, whereas China is about 21%. What's interesting here is that China is by far the most foreign students staying in the U.S., but India is the most retained, that are retaining in the U.S. This has a lot to do because Indian students studying in the U.S. are majority studying for STEM degrees, and majority of India students are actually master's or PhD students. So they're highly desirable by employers. Whereas Chinese students are much more diverse. You have a lot of bachelor's students, you have some graduate degree students, but the majority are still undergraduate degrees. So that's telling us a little bit of a story of why India is being retained in terms of foreign students staying in the US. And here's also another look, whereas you did see this comparison between STEM graduates and non-STEM foreign graduates in the US under OPT, you see that this was a 400% increase from 2008 to 2016 of those graduating with or staying with a STEM degree. That's really a lot, whereas versus non-STEM degree only grew about 49% during the same period. So now let me turn, now let's look at the future. So I used, the United Nations was kind enough to give me this data before the UNDESA, which is the Department of Economic and Social Affairs in New York, gave me this data 3 weeks before it was being released back in June to look at their world population projections. So I did this report looking at what's the world projected to be in by the end of the century. So you see that the world population growth is projected to flatten in the coming decades. So by 2100, according to the UN's population projections, we're about to be, in terms of about 10.9, flatten about 10.9 billion. And this has a lot to do with how global fertility is falling as the world is aging. So you can see here, in terms of replacement rate, is projected to really fall below replacement rate of 2.1 by around the 2080. And then you see also the world is also getting older. Right now it's about 31, the median age is 31, but it's projected to be about 42 by the end of the century. And when you look at these projections by countries, you see that the five of the world's top 10 largest countries are also projected to be in Africa. So really, Africa is where most of the growth is coming from. And you can see that by the end of the century, half of babies born worldwide are expected to be born in Africa. And you see here, Asia is still by far a lot of babies are still being born in Asia as well, but it's projected to drop. And then the population growth, again, in Africa is projected to remain strong throughout the century, whereas, again, in Asia, it's about to fall. And you see other regions about stabilizing or really not growing as much. So given all this information, we know this is going on. We know that the population is the growth is slowing, and only in certain parts of the world are growing. And then we know that there's unauthorized immigration. We also know there's this flow of global talent. And there's also all the many different types of economic migrants or people moving for different reasons. We did a global attitude survey back in 2018 in 27 different countries. We had a module on migration, asking about various questions on migration. So I'm going to give you some of the results because it gives kind of a comparison worldwide. What are people thinking about migration? So we asked this question about, are immigrants today making our country stronger because of their work and talents, or immigrants today are a burden on our country because they take our jobs and social benefits? You see, Canada has a majority, about 68% of the Canadian population believe that immigrants make their country stronger. This is no surprise, but it's interesting. Whereas you see countries that actually experience, especially the Syrian surge, like Greece, Hungary, Italy, are more on the side of that they are a burden. And this big change actually has happened, especially in Greece, Germany, Italy, where you see from 2014 to 2018 this big shift. And this is a question again on are immigrants make our country stronger because of their work and talents. You see that the populations, the publics, have shifted their public opinion on this question. Then we split it by ideology. It's actually quite polarized in some countries. So in the top, the United States, those who identify in the ideological left, about 82.3% believe that immigrants are making their country stronger, whereas those on the right, 37% only believe that they make the country stronger. And you can see the variation by countries. What's interesting here is that Greece, Italy, and also in Poland, you see that whether they're right or left, especially in Greece, the majority, only a few believe that they make their country stronger. So it's really interesting to see, being able to capture this in terms of ideology. And then now looking more deeply at the United States, the U.S., when we asked this question since 1994, it's interesting to see how these patterns change. Back in 94, only 31% of the U.S. population believed that immigrants made the country stronger. But by 2017, 65% of the country believe that immigrants make the country stronger. But when you look at party identification, it's actually really polarized. So 84% of Democrats or leaning Democrats believe immigrants should make the country stronger, whereas only 42% of Republicans believe on immigrants making the country stronger. Now let's turn to integration. So we asked this question about immigrants in our country today want to adopt our customs and way of life, or do immigrants today want to be distinct from our society? What's interesting here is that Japan, which and many people know is a very homogenous society and has actually been very restrictive for a very long time, actually comes on top as 75% thinking that immigrants today want to adopt their customs and way of life. And I was just in Japan last spring and presenting and talking to people and wondering what was going on here. And people did say there was a lot of media in the last couple of years, especially that they're going through a demographic crisis, right? They have a very aging population. They have been a lot in the media. There's been stories about towns being abandoned and homes not being left for no one to inherit. So it's actually quite fascinating how that public relations or the media exposure to that has changed, kind of shifted people's views. And also in Japan, when I was there in April last year, has actually changed its immigration policy. They're actually allowing those who are studying in Japan to actually easily get work permits, because they're really trying to figure out a way of how to get more migrants or people to actually stay, because, you know, Japan is a leader in a lot of technological fields and a lot of in the automotive industry. They need more population. Yes, Omar.
That's a really fascinating statistic, and the question is really interesting too. Do you have a question which disaggregates or differentiates between the different types of immigrants? So I would imagine that obviously certain types of immigrants are more desirable than others. Do you get that in the survey?
So we didn't have enough room because this survey was part of a bigger survey of other attitudes around global issues. But what we do, but we don't have that. And then we only use these words to be as broad as possible in terms of immigrants, but you are correct that there are differences, whether, especially in Japan and other parts of the world, like in the Middle East, you have migrant workers or foreign workers or different from immigrants. So we don't get into that detail, but if we do country-specific surveys, we would do that and disaggregate that. But what's interesting here is that you see the U.S. is actually the majority of population, as well as Canada, believes that they're adopting a way of life, but Canada is actually quite split. But this reflects... Canada's different, though, because remember, everyone knows has this melting pot idea that everyone's going to integrate into American society or the society of their host nation. But in Canada also has, people say, it's a salad bowl. You know, you could come and be distinct. So I think that this is reflecting more in Canada that people have different views or are okay with people being distinct. Now, we have to ask another question. This is a very political question that a lot of politicians start blaming, you know, immigrants for crime. So we ask this question, are immigrants in our country today more to blame for crime than other groups? Or are no more to blame for crime than other groups? You see, actually, the majority, in many countries, half or more say immigrants are no more to blame for crime. But you do see some variations. So again, Canada, many, and US, and France, no more to blame for crime, and also the UK. But you do see other countries, like Greece, Sweden, actually, and South Africa, where majorities believe that they're more to blame for crime. Now turning to deportation. So thinking about immigration, would you support or oppose deporting immigrants currently living in a country illegally? So half or more in several countries would support this, but you do see some variation. The United States, again, is split, as well as Mexico, as well as France, but it's actually ideological too. So when you do this split in terms of ideology, you see that in the U.S. it's split depending on your, if you're left, you wouldn't want to deport people, only 28%, versus 63% those who are right-leaning. But then again, you see some convergence. For Greece, whether you're left or right, they agree on deportation. So same in a little bit in Sweden as well, the majorities, as well as even in the Netherlands. But it's very, but you do see some splits, especially US, France, and Mexico. And now we ask this broader question, around, in your opinion, should we allow more immigrants to move to our country, fewer immigrants, or about the same as we do now? And most of the world want fewer immigrants, but you do see some countries that like about the same level, like Canada, as well as Japan. And then when we ask the question about high-skilled immigration, we say, thinking about immigration, would you support or oppose encouraging high-skilled people to immigrate and work in our country? And a lot of people actually support high-skilled immigration. So you can see here quite a lot of majorities. Other, some countries that don't, like Italy and also Israel, are quite split on this question. But then when we take the subset of those who said we want fewer immigrants in our country, we looked at the results of the same question on high-skilled immigration, and you see that even when you want fewer immigrants, they're actually okay with high-skilled immigrants. So this is what I always call the Miss Universe question. So high-skilled immigration is not a real political issue for many countries. Then we asked a question about refugees. Talking about immigration, would you support or oppose taking refugees from countries where people are fleeing violence or war? And then you see that actually a majority of countries that we've surveyed support taking refugees. And then the last question, this has a lot to do with brain drain, so we wanted to ask, is it a problem for people leaving their country to, for jobs in other countries? And this is the results for those who believe it's a very or moderately big problem. You can see actually Greece, Spain, Hungary, Italy, Philippines, where you have a lot of migrant workers in India, as well as even Japan, they think it's a big problem for people to leave their country for jobs. But for America, for the US and Canada, so for Rachel, it's okay that you've left to work here. They don't have a problem with people leaving. The big destination countries, which is interesting, US, Canada, United Kingdom, actually don't, and Australia, don't have a problem with their people leaving, leaving their jobs for countries around the world. So I will end there. But I'm open to any questions that you have on my presentation or other stuff around the Pew Research Center. Thank you.
So why don't we collect a couple questions? And maybe since there is some quite a number of new faces, just introduce yourself briefly and then pose your question.
Omar McDoom, I'm here with Wider as an Investing Researcher. Thank you. That was really fascinating. I didn't know that Pew collected its own data on migration, and that was fascinating to see the data that you have on the trends. So the question I had then, since you're independently collecting these data, do you find that there are big disparities, differences with countries' own numbers? Because obviously this is highly politicized.
Yeah.
Maybe thinking about what was going on the southern border in the United States, it's still not clear to me what's going on there because there's so much obfuscation around the numbers. So did you find, I don't know, to take the US for example, do you find there are big differences between what you found and what governments are reporting?
So what's interesting for the US case, it's interesting is because the US actually uses our numbers.
Oh, okay.
And the DHS, the Homeland Security, actually did put their own estimate. But it's the exact same method that Jeff Bissell and my team does, so it's actually pretty much comes with the exact same results. So in the U.S. case, they do follow kind of our methodology, which is great. For Europe, it's very different. There hasn't been an estimate done since 2008. So what we did, we had to re-engage with the people who did the Clandestino project back in 2008 to actually understand the methodologies, and it's actually quite... more, it was a lot more challenging than doing the U.S. estimate because of all the variation within Europe of estimating, you know, some have census, some don't have census, some have national registries. That was the most complicated part of this project. But But it actually still was not far off. I don't believe that our numbers are quite reasonable in terms of looking at the estimates. So in terms of a Europe-wide number, it actually is interesting to see that. I mean, we do have some people, you know, that have differences in terms of estimates by, on a country-by-country basis, but the scope of this or this estimation was really more Europe-wide.
Please.
Kayla
Boris, National Coordinator for European Migration Network, which, if you're not aware of, it's EU Commission coordinated network. We do research, the same expertise of desktop research in each EU member state and in Norway with their own money. A comment on terminology. Isn't the US, like a common usage in the USA to use unauthorized? Because whatever terminology you use, it's semantics and it reflects your attitudes. In our studies, and it's an issue that you do see also in any other EU documents, not just the European Migration Network studies, we use irregular and illegal. And I noticed that in your slides you have unauthorized, except when you mentioned return, and then you have illegal. Why?
I
think unauthorized is more neutral. Because to me, even irregular has a certain kind of connotations that can be considered negative towards the person who's here.
That's a great question, and that's the challenge of doing this type of research. So it's all about terminology. So when we're doing the estimation, we use unauthorized, which the general public may not understand what that is. So we had to create that term to make it more all-encompassing in terms of broad enough. Like, we didn't want to use the highly political term, which is illegal or even undocumented. And there's so many different words for it. But unauthorized, and when I presented the slides on illegal, that's our public opinion data. We couldn't use the term unauthorized there because in the public, we tested that question, and then people were like, what is that? So then suddenly we had to put another thing on, you know, on our survey. You would have to explain to them, and it would take too much time, and that's time is money, and the survey gets more expensive, and people were... So what people think is illegal. That was the term that worked in public opinion. But that's a great term. But what we do when we estimate the population, we use unauthorized, which is inclusive of people who entered illegally, inclusive of those who are basically unauthorized and irregular as well. So,
In Europe, we use irregular for all of those. You know, so I picked this up because this is something I would like to take up. And but we also, since 20 years ago, we worked on a migration glossary. And it's version 7 by now. We do update it all the time, and I would like to see even the word irregular to be changed. And I think unauthorized is, like you said, it's more neutral and all encompassing. I'd like to get some support, maybe get in touch with you.
Yeah, definitely. Get in touch. I mean, the one thing that we had challenged though when we were doing this in multiple languages, so when it starts getting tricky once you start doing it in like French or Germany, people are like, what is unauthorized?
Or even irregular for those of you who are from Finland, after a long decision asking opinions from here and there, säännösten vastainen, not säännösten. And for you people use it sometimes. We try and get it to the press also, please use this. And even that, what do you think when you hear säännösten vastainen? But at least it's not illegal.
Good. Thank you so much. Other questions?
Yes. Hi, I'm Fiona Markkinen. I work as a human rights advisor with the Ministry for Foreign Affairs and also follow the issue of migration and development. Thank you for the interesting presentation. And I wanted to ask if you, on the link between migration and development, we know that it's maybe positive on the global level and that many countries benefited from development, both from origin countries and countries of destination. And I was wondering
immigrants have contributed to more development than, for instance, low-skilled workers, or is it vice versa, or is it really that also people move from one category to another, or or are there any arguments based on this that you could also argue that maybe not only high-skilled labor force is the one that contributes to development, or is there any data that we could also be saying low-skilled workers are needed equally as much or have a similar contribution to raising the national GDP?
So we don't have any studies that actually make the direct linkages, but we do have a lot of data points that we released that actually could show that.
Yeah.
We have, we published the, I mean, everyone knows that the World Bank has their remittances, and that's a big contributor to development back in the countries of origin. We have that compiled in an interactive on our website that shows by country, by which corridor, it has all the data flows in terms of money that's being flowing, that's flowing because of migrants. In terms of skills, I mean, that's a great question. For those who are staying longer, high-skilled immigrants in the United States, I published a piece, several pieces on Pew at Pew Research Center showing their salaries, which are very high, and you could see by what occupations people are working in, which is really in the IT computer sector, very high-skilled occupations. But we don't have a paper that's showing the direct link, but we have all the data points that actually, if someone, a researcher wanted to show that, you could take that.
Well, if there's nobody else, is there anybody else? No. Okay. So when I hear the term immigrant, I imagine that the word immigrant, when you use it in whatever language, that your survey respondent has in the back of his or her mind an image of who the average immigrant is for their country, and that image will vary quite dramatically, I imagine, between countries, and probably shapes their attitudes towards immigration and immigrants more generally. So I wondered, that was a global attitude survey, but you also have country-specific ones, and I wonder, do you ask questions that try to get in, to try to get to this issue of who do they think of as the average immigrant when they're answering that question? Because I think that must shape their views on immigration.
I mean, that's an excellent question. So I was just in a conference in Israel, actually, just last month on this topic. And one of the things that I did a deep dive looking at Israel in particular, which was fascinating, is to see that, so you saw they're very negative on when you ask broadly about immigration. But then people were raising their hands going, wait, hold on, did you ask a question about Jewish immigrants? What are your results for that? Because what is the image of immigrants? Because what if someone's immigrating into Israel, but they're Jewish, you would have a very different view than what is the average immigrant that they're thinking about. So in 2016, Pew did a study on Israel, a very deep dive on religions, a religious survey, and they asked this question on immigration, and it was specifically about Jewish immigrants. And you had near unanimous, about 98% of Israel's Jewish population believe that people should have the that they're okay with people immigrating and becoming a citizen of Israel. So that, but then if you ask questions about something else, foreign worker or a temporary worker, that would be very different. They would have different attitudes. So, or of course, given that they're, you know, complicated conflict zone, that very different views if you add some very specific questions on specific countries or specific people coming in. So that's very different attitude. So yes, it's hard. I know in Japan when I was in Asia, and also if you're in the Middle East, there's a big foreign or migrant temporary worker programs there. And so if immigrant is different from foreign worker or migrant worker. So if we do deep dives, we would ask those and help the public distinguish, because I think they have different views on and your typical immigrant usually means permanent immigration, but it could also be broad. And as we saw in our Israel public survey, I think people might be are not thinking of Jewish immigrants, they're thinking of non-Jewish immigrants.
Just saying about two questions. What is, I guess in Europe you'll find, even in Schengen space where we don't have any like physical borders or any reason to stop between two countries, but still there exists some invisible barriers, and because migrants are different. Like in Portugal, we have maybe a bigger prevalence of Portuguese-speaking migrants as well, in Spain, different in France, different, etc. Mm. So one question is, do you also have the same situation in the U.S., between states of the U.S., where it's actually the same thing?
In terms of?
Different profiles of migrants in different states.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And another is, when you look into the general opinion about migrants, does that change with prevalence of migrants where you live? And is it the case that sometimes seems that anecdotal that people that actually don't have that many migrants living next to them do fear them?
Yep. So that's a great question. And some, I didn't present that work, but we do have some subnational level work, and that's actually very important. You definitely do see variation of where migrants live in the United States. So of course, if you go to California, California has many migrants. And also the coastal cities, and also those along the border with Mexico has a lot of migrants from. But if you did see a wave, especially going to into the Midwest, of new populations of immigrants in this last decade as well. In terms of attitudes, I think we have this aggregate data. We did a community survey, not my team, but our social demographics team did a very localized surveys looking at kind of community views on different issues, like racial issues as well as on immigration, and you do see variation whether they're from rural parts or less exposure to other people not like them. The views vary. So we have those types of surveys. So you do see subnational. This is always a national and, of course, comparison for an international level, but when you do subnational, it actually gets very interesting because cities are different from rural or suburban, especially in the United States.
Another question. I was very intrigued by your very first sentence where you said that you have an annual report on what 36 countries in the world.
Yes.
Migration. What kind of issue does it impair? Because BMN has been doing the same for Europe now for the 11th year, an annual study on migration and asylum issues. So I'm very interested in hearing. And how long have you been doing that?
So this is the first time we've added, it's the 2018 GAP survey is the first time we've added a migration module onto the survey. And it rotates. So 2019, we didn't have it. 2020, we have a few questions that are coming up. And just to give you a heads up, we are expanding the Global Attitudes Project. It's actually expanding to 50 countries, especially in the Global South. So we will have more countries this coming year with countries added in sub-Saharan Africa and in Southeast Asia. So we're going to have a bigger more countries in the survey. And I guess the reason why it's done every year, we have a whole team, so it's not me, but we have a Global Attitudes team that just focuses on just the survey. And we have teams that just focus only on their one part. So our part's just really global migration demography, mm-hmm. but we work with other teams to kind of add questions into the survey.
Will you be having Malaysia on the Southeast Asian?
Yes, I think we're adding Malaysia. I think we might be having Thailand. Yeah, we'll be adding.
It's some country where you have a lot of foreign workers.
Yes.
From the region.
Yeah, like Thailand in particular too, yes.
Just to pick up on that, so there are some migration questions in all the Global Attitude Surveys, but then this is the
This was the biggest one, yeah. The 2018 was the big one. Yeah.
Any other questions? We're close, coming to a close, but I wanted to ask you more broadly, how can researchers use your data and access your data and mm-hmm. connect with your project team?
So all our data is always going to be is public, so we don't charge anything. This is public good at Pew Research Center. So usually when we publish a report, if you see a report publishing on any data, especially our public opinion work, it's available 1 year after that. So you could request the raw data, you could ask for special cuts. We'll usually either allow it or not. I mean, depending on the we would have to look if how much we filter, if it's actually still nationally or representative of whatever, if it's reportable or not. And we're more than welcome to share that data. So we do have a lot of academics who always ask for our data, and they do papers on it, and it's very typical. So all this data will be available for the public to use.
Thank you. Any final questions? Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.